Okay, so then we get this statement, she's an organ of vision. She holds to no dharma whatsoever. Or there's statements like, she does nothing about all dharmas, or she never produces any dharmas and she's not stopped by them. So we go into a section of the hymn, and it's got normal kind of sounding bits. So she guides the path, those who strayed onto a bad road. She's forsaken all defilements. She's the mother of the Bodhisattva. So the sort of, you read through this bit of him, the sort of normal sounding bits that you can kind of get the hang of. And then there's these mysterious bits. She does nothing about all dharmas, never produces any dharmas. It's not capital B, D, it's little d. Doesn't stop any dharma. And is herself unstopped by them. And so that's about it. So to kind of fathom a bit of what this is, we need to know what a dharma is. And that means going back to the what I was saying about the exchange between Buddha and Subhuti about eye making and mind making. So the eye making and mind making is the basic root cause of our suffering. That's what's been said, because it's the fundamental delusion which underlies our craving. So at the moment, we stand on this fundamental delusion. And what we need to do is to take flight into understanding actually the fundamental principle that underlies all things. But at the moment, we're involved in eye-making and mind-making. And the truth of things, as identified by the Buddha, is the insubstantial nature of all phenomena. So when we try to make things I or mine in that kind of convinced way that we have that there's something solid in us, we're going to always fail. We're always going to, our experience is always going to deny that inner kind of ground wish that we have. It's never really going to be satisfied in that way. So we're always going to be feeling unsatisfactoriness at quite a deep level. And even when the experience itself is pleasant enough, underneath there'll be something left not satisfied. And it's because of this, you know, constant kind of harping on eye making and mind making that where we go wrong. So meditation's geared to weakening that view of self. So it's geared to weakening the view of self, but also to strengthening our capacity to live beyond that view of self. So it's important to know that there's both there. So meditation, as we do it, weakens the view of self, but also strengthens our capacity to live without it. So there's there's both things going on. Sometimes it can be a bit hard, actually, or even a bit, feel a bit apprehensive sometimes with some meditation experience, where you can feel that you're touching into a different way of experiencing yourself, but actually doesn't feel very easy. There can be a measure of fear in it. So good to remember that as well as weakening that view of self, it also strengthens our capacity to live without it. And to live without it means living in a realm of imaginative, empathetic connection with other beings. And if we could do that, that would mean to live with aligned with reality. So that's the promise being held out. That's when we can do that, that's when the perfection of wisdom becomes a light and illumines the world. That's when we can partake of that ourselves. That's the promise, that's the possibility that's being held out. The cost is that we need to die to ourself as something fixed, something substantial, a sort of organising core in us that's in the middle. Empirically, as we were saying before, empirically, our empirical experience of ourselves will carry on. But in reality, it's not like how it presents itself to us. It's not fixed and substantial in this organizing process in the middle of us. That's what we need to die to. We need to die to that view. That's the cost. After that comes the promise of freedom and light. But there is a cost to it, and so perfection of wisdom is the quintessence of that wisdom. And she as a figure, as a bodhisattva figure, is also the embodiment of living like that, the embodiment of being able to live without that view. Okay, so go back to dharmas. It's a meditation technique, where we break down this view of self and also break down the world and break them into their parts, as it were, especially, it's easy enough to do it with world. But it's especially important to do it with self. So we're just breaking our sense of ourself down into its different aspects, different parts, as it were, in order to break down our insistence on it being substantial. So it's a means to an end. So we keep having this insistence that we really are substantial and we really could stand substantially on something if only we could find something substantial to stand on. So with this insistence, and the meditation techniques are there to kind of break down that by just going, look at the experience, look at the details of it. Where is anything that has that, solid centre to it? So there's various ways of doing it. So you can use a framework called the five skandhas, which are five skandhas are consciousness, feeling, form, perception, and volition. And there's a whole meditation around looking at one's experience in those terms, and we will do some of that later in the week. There are ways of doing it. So you can reflect on the nidanas around the outside of the wheel of life, or you can reflect on the six elements. And those three, skandhas, nidanas, and six elements, they're all insight meditation practices, and they're all designed to illumine the insubstantial and impermanent nature of self, and also illumine the suffering which comes from not knowing that, really not deeply knowing that. We kind of do know that intellectually, but we don't know it deep down. So the insight meditations illumine that's our nature, illuminate that nature of us, and they also show up in relief, the suffering that emerges from it. And they show up that suffering in ourselves, but they also show us that suffering emerging in other people. So when we do those reflections for ourselves, and we also do them, by reflecting on other people, and out of that awareness of suffering, compassion arises, and also sometimes an awareness of the sameness that there is between us and other beings. So again, we touched on that this afternoon. So the suffering arises from not doing that. That's basically the suffering that arises from ignorance, spiritual ignorance, not knowing about conditionality. The basic suffering arises from the unenlightened state. So that's, our normal experience of ourselves as an empirically existing self is not going to disappear. It doesn't get snuffed out in a certain way, insight. That carries on. But the self and other kind of breakdown lines that we have, demarcation lines that we have, that gets reoriented, as it were. So there's not a distinction any longer in terms of we'd wish ourselves more good fortune or happiness than we would other people. That doesn't happen. So it's quite like the Metta Bhavana or any of the Brahma Viharas last stage, if you're really doing it. And it is where the Brahma Viharas, I think, move into something of akin to an insight practice, that last stage. To really do it, I think you really have to pay attention to the first half of the last stage, where you equalise what you feel around all the people that you've had in the other stages. That's an important part of that last stage. Sometimes we skip it a bit, I think. So those early Buddhist meditation practices, they were there to break our experience down, and they brought them into what were called dharmas, made up of form and mental states and then events. There's various long lists of them, which I won't go into. So it was an early kind of set of insight practices which broke through selfhood into our Buddha nature.